You are listening to the Brighton Book Club on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, a monthly show about books and writing in Brighton and beyond. Today we speak to two Brighton-based writers, Joe Furness and Cassie Bruce, about their new novels Dead Mile and Sirens Bay. Dead Mile is a gripping thriller set in a traffic jam, and Sirens Bay is an enemies-to-lovers small-town romance that will have you swooning. Both books need to be on your summer reading radars. We also speak to the excellent Sophie Flynn about her new novel What Stays Unsaid, a thriller set over a hen weekend in Dartmoor. The show is also available as a podcast where you can download from wherever you get yours, and if you enjoy it, give us a review and tell your book loving mates. If you have a suggestion for the show, you can email us at btnbookclub@gmail.com and follow us on Instagram at btnbookclub, where you can find details about all the books we've spoken about on today's show. Enjoy. Sergeant Belinda Billy Kidd is driving home from the airport, jet-lagged and ready to resign from a career that has left her traumatised. Menopause has robbed her confidence too. Now she's a traffic cop who's afraid to drive. When brake lights hemorrhage up the motorway, the cars grind to a halt. Moments later, she finds a dead driver in a black sedan. He has a metal skewer in his neck. But why? But how? The killer can't have left the scene without being spotted by dozens of witnesses, so he must still be there, among them. If the traffic jam stays put, they're all in danger. If the traffic clears, she'll lose her suspect. The clock is ticking, but she doesn't know how fast. Author of Dead Mile, Joe Furness, is with me in the Brighton Book Club studio. Welcome back, Joe.
Hi, Anna. It's lovely to be back on the Brighton Book Club.
I love the concept for Dead Mile and think this is an absolutely thrilling page turner of a novel. When did this idea come to you?
Oh, it's good to hear that. The idea came to me, actually, probably not surprisingly, on a motorway going into Brighton. I was literally driving down to Brighton one day. I was in the passenger seat of the car. The traffic all came to a stop, I guess, on the A27. We were in the middle lane and, we sort of stopped right up hard against the car that was also stopped in the slow lane. And I suddenly had this sort of moment of thinking, gosh, it's such a strange environment, the motorway, because one moment it's super anonymous. Everyone's kind of whizzing along in their own vehicles and you just don't, you don't even see the faces of other people. And then the moment the traffic stops, you're actually really up close and personal with everyone. I could have put my arm out my window and literally touched the window of this guy that was suddenly next to me. So then all of a sudden it's really intimate. And I had this idea that, isn't this a great sort of setup for a novel? Because there's not many places in our lives that are so democratic. There's not many places where you could literally meet anyone from any walk of life, but the fact is everyone has to get about, everyone uses the motorway, everyone drives around. So it's a really sort of rare opportunity to throw all different people together into this sort of crucible situation of high stress that happens when you're in a traffic jam. And that was the kind of the first germ of the idea. I just sort of thought, I love writing characters. So I just thought, oh, this would be a great fun because every car contains a different character, contains a different story. And because I write crime, contains a suspect. So that was kind of where I started.
Yeah, that leads me really nicely on to talk about Belinda Billy Kidd as your protagonist. How did Belinda come to you?
She came to me, a rare character that just sort of walks into the room and I could see her and hear her. I didn't have to do too much work really with her. I just sort of knew her. And I knew sort of the spirit of her, I suppose. And then she sort of developed a little bit as the story went along, obviously, as I tend to draft and redraft an awful lot. Mm-hmm. So my first draft is sort of her kind of moving around a bit like a marionette. You know, she just sort of goes around and she does all the things that she needs to do. And then as I continued drafting, I realized that she's a bit soulless somehow, you know, like my main character's a bit soulless, and I had to kind of dig a bit deeper and sort of find out who she really is and kind of, you know, why. Kind of, it's fine that all of these things are happening, but I think there's always a moment when I'm writing where I think, okay, but why? Like, why is this happening now? Why is she here now? And I wanted the story to almost have a slightly surreal, almost a surreal sense of that she's here, that she's having this kind of dark night of the soul, almost like her life has been paused for a moment to give her an opportunity to do something, to change something. And so I sort of took that concept and actually sort of extrapolated it to all of the characters. So everyone in their car almost has a dark night of the soul. Everyone changes during this experience of being stuck together on the motorway, but Billy more than anyone else. So as you mentioned there in the blurb, you know, she's just been away on this trip. She's actually kind of had almost like a little career break for 6 months where she's been away and spent some time with her sister out of the country. She's had quite a few problems in her career as a police officer. She's given her life to being a police officer, and she started to feel that it hasn't given her very much back. Mm. And she's wondering where she's going. And it was almost a funny part of the process in my own head, was I'm writing this book, which is obviously set on a motorway where everyone's broken down. And I'm thinking, what is it? What is it about? What is it about? And then you think, well, it's so obvious, like all that, you think of all the metaphors that I've just written in there, like, you know, they're broken down. She's in the slow lane. She's lost her path. She's lost her way. She doesn't know where she's going. I mean, you could just go on forever, right? There's so much symbolism going on there. And I thought, oh, there you go. That's it. That's the heart of her. She's a woman who's trying to find her way. She's sort of involuntarily childless. She's sort of at that stage of life where, you know, that isn't going to happen for her. She's 50, early 50s. And her career has been everything for her. And so when that has sort of possibly failed, she's kind of left with nothing, and she's trying to work out what she is left with. And this is a sort of a chance for her to have a new start, really, to sort of prove to herself that she can do it, prove to everyone that she can do it, and get back on the right path.
So this seems like a better time than any to hear an extract. Can you tell us a bit what bit you're going to read for us?
Okay, yeah, so it's just a little short bit. This is a little extract from chapter 5, so I need to set it up a tiny bit. So as you mentioned, the main character is called Sergeant Belinda Kidd, but everyone calls her Billy. She's just landed back in England off this long-haul flight from Australia. She leaves the airport and drives straight into this traffic jam. And within moments, the drivers realise that this man in a black sedan in the inside lane isn't moving. He's obviously dead, and it would appear that he's been murdered. And as the only police officer on the scene, Billy starts to investigate. Now, this section of motorway is lined on both sides by huge sound barriers. So Billy sort of comes to the conclusion that the killer can't possibly have left the scene. There's nowhere for them to have gone without being seen. So they must still be there among them. And she goes over to sort of check out these sound barriers and just make sure that that sort of deduction is true. So here we go. This is from chapter 5. Billy pressed her ear to the barrier, but heard only a rushing sound like the sea, which made no sense whatsoever. Must be blood in her ears. But it gave her a Truman Show-esque sense of disorientation. Maybe I'm dead and this is purgatory, stuck forever on a motorway, going nowhere. She turned and the sensation popped. A normal Friday, traffic jam, red lights, angry faces, dead driver in a black sedan. Why would a killer attack in a place where they couldn't get away? Some sixth sense made her look over in time to see movement beyond the central reservation, close to where Daisy stood with Ollie. A dull whoomp as a man from the southbound side collided belly first with the metal safety barrier that divided the two carriageways. Daisy yelped in shock at the impact behind her and ran forward, dragging Ollie out of harm's way. The two youngsters ended up cowering beside his camper van. The intruder failed to jump the divider, but got one arm hooked over and started struggling to climb up. Billy strode across to where the man clung to the central reservation, one elbow and now one ankle over the metal barrier. As she approached, his shoe fell off and landed at her feet. "What are you doing?" she asked. The barrier came up to her chest. This man had found out the hard way that it was designed to be difficult to cross. He hauled himself up with a huge effort and a long groan until he was perched on top of the metal rail, looking about as convincing as Putin on a horse. The leg of his grey sweatpants was now tie-dyed with black grime. "We've lost all control over this country," announced the spokesman from the southbound carriageway to the people of the northbound carriageway. "They're not telling us the half of it," he yelled, then toppled forward so that he laid along the fence in the posture of a sloth. A disembodied voice called out from the man's own side, "You're drunk, go home." "I don't drink," shouted the man on the fence. "Alcohol is the opium of the masses." The omnipotent voice called out, "That's religion, you dipstick."
Thank you so much, Joe. What's really coming through there is a sense of kind of humour within this crime. Was that something that kind of came consciously to you when you were writing it?
Not really. I didn't set out to write a crime with an element of comedy in it. Although it's interesting that in this last year or so, there've been loads of comic crime novels. In fact, I'm doing a couple of events around Brighton with other authors who have sort of also kind of gone down this line. So it's one of those mysterious publishing things that happens where obviously there's a sort of something in the ether and lots of authors pick up on it. And, you know, you have several books sort of with a running theme through them that come out around the same time. I think the humour arrived, like I said, really with Billy, with this character. It's just her way of coping with the stresses of her life as a police officer. I used to be a journalist sort of in another life. I worked at the BBC. So, and that's quite common in the newsroom as well, that kind of slight gallows humour. I think it's a way of just sort of letting off steam a little bit when you sort of see and hear things that are, you know, sort of fairly stressful. And I feel like from what I know of police officers, that's pretty commonplace there as well. So it felt natural to give her that. And I guess when I'm writing it, it's quite nice to sort of, when you write from a point of view that's very close to one character, which I do, this whole novel is told just from her point of view and pretty close in on her point of view. There's a great opportunity there for that sort of dramatic irony where the reader gets to see something that the other characters don't. Mm. So we have that sort of access to her inner thoughts, and we know what she thinks of these people as she meets them. And sometimes that's, you know, her sort of impression in her head of them is different to what she actually says out loud to them. And so you sort of get this sense of how she's coping, how she's sort of almost manipulating this whole situation and going about her business. And the humour just sort of came out of that. So some of it is her kind of slightly snarky reactions to people. And then also just the sort of the comedy that lies in, as I said before, really, the sort of the unique experience of all these people from all different walks of life just suddenly thrown together. And the way everybody sort of reacts to that, I think, is just sort of naturally quite funny, to be honest. I find people generally in life quite funny. So that just kind of came through in the book.
So this is kind of a new take on the locked room thriller, right?
Yeah.
What locked room thrillers have inspired you? And what is it about that just makes it so perfect for writing crime?
I think I saw it a little bit as a puzzle, as a challenge, as a writer to actually do that. And I thought of this idea of like, okay, so it's a murder mystery set entirely in a traffic jam. And she's got no outside help. Billy's got no outside help. There's no one for her to go to. She's not in her police car. She's just in her own car. So she doesn't have any kit. She doesn't have a uniform. She doesn't have a radio. She doesn't have any of the things that a police officer would need. So she's almost in a sort of castaway situation where she's having to kind of make it up as she goes along. And she literally spends some time sort of cobbling together sort of like she wants some plastic bags for her hands so that she can preserve the evidence. So she has to sort of go off and find things that she can use. So she's having to be really resourceful all the time. But in terms of the actual sort of mystery, the crime, it just felt like a real challenge to do it, to think how is she then going to get this information out of everybody? She can't go and look stuff up. She can't have any sort of outside help, really. There is one person that she can sort of phone who becomes another character in it, but apart from that, so it felt really sort of pure in that sense, like you really just have to follow through the steps of her sort of investigation as she goes. And I when I realized it was a locked room mystery, it's not something that I've written before, so I ordered like a whole bunch of other books, sort of modern locked room mysteries. So people like Ruth Ware or Lucy Foley, all these people that are obviously like knocking it out of the park in this, you know, in this genre. And I kind of went through and I almost sort of, you know, deconstructed them and tried to work out how they're doing it. And then I also then at that point, I think, decided to try to do something that was slightly different, in the sense that very often those kinds of books are written from multiple points of view, multiple perspectives, and you sort of hop into different chapters from different, you know, characters. And I thought, again, sort of sticking to this very pure idea of, no, it's just Billy going through this investigation, I thought, I'm not going to do that. Actually, we're literally, we only find out what she finds out. It just felt like a, it felt like a challenge, which so, I think I need sometimes.
Yeah.
Keep my own interest, you know.
So we talked a bit about the market before and how the book market is always changing and warping in terms of what people want. How do you make your work stand out in such a saturated market?
I think it's really hard. I think it's the hardest problem, particularly in this genre. Well, I mean, certain genres, you know, crime fiction or romance, that are just really saturated. And there's so many writers that are sort of brand name writers, who obviously, you know, rightly get a huge amount of attention. It's also a market that is obsessed with debuts. So for someone like me, this is my fourth published novel. I'm sort of in that weird sort of limbo area of, I'm not a debut, but I'm not a brand name author. So yeah, how do you stand out? And I think for me, it was sort of coming up with an idea that has a really strong hook. And I think I got very sort of, impatient with writing this novel. Like, as soon as I had the idea, I thought to myself, I just have to get this one out, because I think it's the first time I've had such a hooky idea for a book. Just that central concept of it's a murder mystery on a motorway. People grasp that idea really quickly. And everybody I mentioned it to was like, oh, I've not heard that before. And I think as soon as you've got any kind of novelty, then you've got to kind of go for it. So I kind of rewrote this sort of as fast as urgently as I could, to, you know, desperately hoping that no one else would come up with it. Because, you know, there have been like a huge rush of novels set on aeroplanes, for example. There was, you know, a whole bunch of crime. And some of those are even sort of coming through now onto the TV. There's like been a couple of TV crime thrillers set in aeroplanes. So it's weird how these things, they're sort of fashions almost.
So you spoke a bit about writing this book quite fast. What is, or for this one, for Deb Meyer, what was your writing process? You know, what does a day in the life of Jo Furness look like when you are writing?
Mainly chaos, if I'm honest. How do I write? I don't know. I'm very much sort of squeezing it in around lots of other things. I have a sort of a paid job, a day job that I do as well, that's freelance, and I have school age kids, so I basically tend to have a daily word limit that I will hit if I possibly can. I'm the sort of person where I don't write much more than that, even if I have more time. So I love the idea of coming, like doing your retreat, for example, but I fear that I actually wouldn't write any more than 2,000 words a day, even if I had, you know, a big long, the whole day to write. That's like my max. So if I can write a chapter a day, I'm pretty happy. But then I do a lot of redrafting, a lot of going just over and over and over, and sort of round in circles almost. So I'll sort of write a couple of chapters and then almost go back to the beginning of those, rework those chapters, and then move on another couple of chapters, go back. I probably make it laborious. And I do a degree of planning as well. I'd sort of plan this one out. But I moved agents with this book. So that was another part of the process, was that I did sort of some editing with one agent, and then I moved to another agent and did more editing with them. So it took, although I say I wrote it quickly, I wrote it urgently, it did actually take quite a lot and quite a lot of drafts and redrafts to get it right.
Jo, what is on your reading list this summer?
So this summer I've ordered myself a couple actually of real classic locked room mysteries. So one is called The Hongjin Murders, which is has been recommended to me. It's one of the most famous sort of Japanese crime novels of all time, I think, and it's supposed to be a real classic of the genre, really ingenious. So I'm looking forward to jumping into that. It's just a little slender book. And I've also ordered another classic called If on a Winter's Night, a Traveller by Italo Calvino, which I am ashamed to say I've never read. And it's one of those ones that I feel like it's a hole in my reading list that I need to kind of go and fill in. So those two will be coming on holiday with me this summer.
And what's next for you writing wise, Jo? What are you working on?
So Dead Mile is the start of a 4-book deal. So I'm sort of committed to writing a book a year for the next 4 years. I've written the next one in this deal, which is unconnected, but it's called Guilt Trip. And it's about a school. It's about a lot of parents who are called into school sort of unexpectedly one Monday afternoon because a minibus full of their children has just disappeared. It's just vanished. And they're all sort of pushed into the school hall. There's kind of 5 sets of parents, and they all start to kind of turn on each other a little bit as they try to work out kind of why the bus has been taken and which one of them is sort of responsible. They feel that someone there must be the cause of this happening, and it all gets quite nasty. So again, it's got that kind of closed circle element to it with all these parents kind of turning on each other. But unfortunately, Billy isn't in that novel. I'm hoping that I might have a chance to bring Sergeant Billy Kidd back for something else because I do love her.
Jo, thank you so much for joining us. Dead Mile is out now with all good retailers. Jo, how can we find and follow you and keep abreast of anything you've got coming out?
I have a website, which is just jofurness.com, but I'm most active on Instagram. I think I'm at Jo Furness Author. So drop me a line there.
Grief-stricken British war reporter Emma James has retreated to her Washington, D.C. apartment on forced medical leave. She's all alone except for her new house guest, a tabby cat called Tallulah, entrusted to her by her beloved mentor on his deathbed. Astonishingly, he has also bequeathed her a cottage in a small town in Maine she's never heard of, Sirens Bay. What or who will she find there? Jordan Allen is a handsome local contractor, sculptor, and former Marine. After returning home to Sirens Bay following a tragedy, finally, he's feeling good about life again. Like Emma, he's not about to let a romance upend his plans. So when a quest to warn a looming environmental disaster draws them together, it becomes clear Emma and Jordan do, in fact, share a lot in common. They just don't know it yet. Cassie Bruce, welcome to the Brighton Book Club.
Hello, thank you very much for having me.
And congratulations on the publication of Sirens Bay. How does it feel to have it out in the world?
To be honest, I think I'm still in a little bit of shock. So I self-published the book. So writing it seemed to be the big task. But then once it's written, you're then into the production of the book and the tiny details. And I think a part of my brain is still processing little publishing questions and admin tasks, and so I haven't quite landed with it yet, although it was on sale. I have seen it on sale in Kemp Town Bookshop and signed it for someone who bought a copy of my book, so that was a surreal and wonderful moment that has made it seem more real.
So we're going to talk more about the publishing a bit later on, but I'd love to start with your character, your heroine, Emma James. How did you get to know her? When did you first realise you wanted to write this story?
I wanted to write a romance. I wanted, to be honest, I'd written another book, my first novel, and pitched it and hadn't got an agent for it. And I wanted to write something different and fun, and I love romance. I love the tropes and the structure and the satisfaction of them, and I also love modern romance. So I think when you say you're a romance writer or reader, people assume that you are writing kind of heroines in distress who need to be rescued, and I wouldn't ever write a heroine like that. And I liked Emma because she was adventurous, curious, but she doesn't quite know herself. And I liked writing a character who perhaps you don't immediately warm to her, but you know where she's coming from, and she's making choices, and she has her own agency. and she's independent, and yeah, she has a life that she's leading on her own terms. So I wanted to write a character like that and enjoyed it very much.
What sort of authors inspired your writing? It reminds me a lot of Emily Henry.
She is my number one. So I've just finished Funny Story, which I loved. And I was also very thrilled to know that Happy Place, when I bought Happy Place, I was like, oh, it's set in Maine, like my book. So that was wonderful as well. I love her settings, actually. I love that Funny Story is set on Lake Michigan, and it's this beautiful, evocative landscape. And then, as I said, Happy Place is set in Maine. So I could relate to some of the aspects of Maine that she picked out. And I try to do that with my book, is to kind of create a setting that feels like part of the story. So perhaps the landscape reflects some of the moods in the book, or some of the twists and the turns. So yeah, she's my number one, I guess. I also enjoy Sally Thorne, Hating Game. I love that. She writes a brilliant sex scene, I think, and that's a skill. I think that would be my top two in terms of romance writers.
I think this is the perfect time for us to hear some. Please, can you read an extract?
Yeah. So I'm going to read, we're a couple of pages in, so it's not the very beginning, but it's pretty close. Emma glanced behind her. The debris of a Korean takeout and a dirty selection of mugs and glasses littered the surface of the coffee table. Usually, her place was pristine, like a hotel suite she barely slept in. Whoever was behind the door didn't need to see her mess. She loosened the chain and stuck her eye in the crack. Courier pushed a large brown envelope through the gap. "Have a great day, ma'am," he sang as he retreated down the corridor. "Great day," Emma mumbled to herself as she held the packet out in front of her. Unlikely. She frowned. Who was sending a trap mail? A pink slip from the informer? She'd done everything they'd asked since the episode in the office. She hadn't meant to scare her colleagues. It was unfortunate that an 18-wheeler backfired directly below her desk and sent her diving to the floor, trembling and fighting for breath. Later, she had sat with her head in her hands, her cheeks aflame, and tears of embarrassment stinging the backs of her eyes. Louise had to explain to her what had happened. Emma turned over the envelope. She'd worked for the paper for more than a decade, most of her career travelling to all corners of the earth, no questions asked, risking her life at times to be the first to a story. If they were going to fire her, they'd better get ready for a fight. She'd resisted medical leave, pleading with Louise that she knew that she would recover faster if she was allowed back into the fray. Her boss, never one to sugarcoat a situation, said, "Not this time." She told her she was a liability. There were HR hoops, and she, Emma, had to jump through them, just like anyone else. Emma had left Louise's office, rage washing away her shame, slamming the door behind her, before a boss had a chance to make good on her threat to call security, although apparently that had been the last thing Louise had wanted to do. Emma had opened the curtains and let the midday light stream into her living room. She perched on the edge of her distressed leather sofa, the most expensive thing she owned, clutching the courier pouch. She wasn't sure if she wanted to know what was inside. She didn't know if she could take another blow. Loss had already mined a pit so deep in her stomach, if she fell any further, she might never claw her way out. She took a deep breath, reassured by the thought that Ben would be spitting feathers if he knew they had let her go. He'd tell her to contest it. He'd battled against retirement until the bitter end. If he was still alive and editor emeritus at the International Informer, she could count on him to have her back. He'd always protected her, in the field and the office, while teaching her to fight her corner. Tough love was his style, but he was consistent and honest, reliable. Couldn't say that about many people. Emma tore at the package to reveal a second envelope. Swallowing her impatience, she gently tugged at the seal. This was like that annoying kids' game of pass the parcel, where wrapper after wrapper came off until all that was left was a tube of candy. She pulled out a sheaf of papers attached to a courtesy slip from Gutman, Phillips and Schwartz, attorneys at law. A note addressed to her, just her first name, blue ink pen on heavy grain white paper, slid from the bundle onto her lap. Her breath caught in her chest. She knew that handwriting. It wasn't a severance notice from the office. This bold cursive covered post-its and notepads all over Ben's office. She unfurled the letter on her knee. "Dearest Emma, Please accept this gift from me. There's no one else I'd rather leave it to. See you on the other side, Ben.
Oh, thank you so much, Cassie. I read and absolutely loved Siren's Bay. So I'm really, really excited to be able to talk to you about it. So I would, although we didn't really hear about Jordan Allen here, I want to know about writing the kind of ideal man in a romance. Like, what was that process like for you?
It's a good question. It's an interesting one because you want, I think as a writer, you want to balance, or I certainly did, you want to balance the classic tropes of a romance hero. Like, I want to read about a handsome guy, somebody who is appealing and attractive. And at the same time, it isn't just the superficials that make him attractive. He needs to be caring, kind, interested, have something about him, have his own sort of point of view and strengths. So I think that's really interesting in contemporary romance, how you balance those two things. And I did make him, have him as a carpenter and a former Marine. And I love that. I love those kind of sort of classic, almost cliche tropes. But he also listens, he cares. He is not emasculated by her. He doesn't fret over her strengths. So that was very important to me, to write a hero who is appealing in that way.
Absolutely. So let's talk a bit more about the self-publishing process. So a bit like what you alluded to earlier, you know, writing the book is kind of really just a small proportion of it, because you need to become, you know, project manager, designer, blurb writer, kind of production manager. What have you learned about the self-publishing process? What do you wish you knew?
I think I'm very glad I've done it, so that when I self-publish my next book, all those questions and choices that I had to make, I will know that they are coming. So it's the tiny details of things. So the book is very precious to me. I've spent some time writing it. I love my characters. I love the setting. And I want to get it out and share it with the world. So it can often seem that the tiny choices that you make in the publishing process feel really weighted. And you feel under quite a lot of pressure then to make the right choices. So I'll give you a tiny example, but a book needs an ISBN, which is its identity number. And of course, if you work in publishing, you understand entirely how that works, where you buy them, what strategy you might use to buy them, how you get them published on your book. You know, if you're publishing on Amazon, do you need to buy one? All these choices and questions, you know the answer to. And for me, it was a very steep learning curve. And that's just one aspect, because as you said, you are both, you're project managing something. So you're the publisher. You're the bookseller, you're the client commissioning the designer, you're the person commissioning a cover designer, talking about the blurb. So it's a lot of, you wear a lot of different hats, and there's also an element of timing in all these things. And if you haven't done it before, you're never quite sure what needs to be done when, or what can be, or what you can be doing while something else is being done. Which is to say, all of it is possible. It's all doable. And I would encourage anyone to do it if they were interested in self-publishing. It's not it's not too much, but you are juggling lots of tasks and potentially lots of delegation all at the same time. And it's kind of the responsibility rests on your shoulders.
So Siren's Bay is the first in a series. Have you plotted out the whole series? And what does that process look like for you?
I haven't plotted out the whole series, but I plotted out and started on book two. So, which I had begun before I moved into the self-publishing process, but then that took up so much headspace that I kind of had parked my writing, put that to one side. So the way that I plotted book one worked really well for me. I had a spreadsheet, and I had significant events in the narrative, in the kind of the overriding story. So Sirens Bay tells the story of an environmental catastrophe, and Emma gets involved with a local, with an ailing local paper to help raise awareness of this catastrophe. So that, that and her journey to save the local paper is this kind of drives a plot line. And then within that, there are the, there's the romance plot and her and his internal and external feelings, and ups and downs. So I had a, so I had a spreadsheet of like five different rows with the thing, with the things that were happening at that point in time. That makes sense. So that just worked really well for me because it was easy to keep an eye on the main storyline, then keep track of what was happening to my two characters externally and also internally. And I think that's a key thing for romance, is that as in addition to that external challenges and events that your characters encounter, internally they need to waver up and down, meet challenges, overcome them, meet another challenge. You know, that you need to be really explicit with the doubt or the distrust or the miscommunication. So that's, that is my Excel method. And it also feels really good, actually, to write a book that way. It feels very creative. I can understand that people would think that that is quite a tight and disciplined way to write. But actually, I think the constraints of the romance genre mean that you have lots of fun finding out solutions to problems as you move along your plot.
Absolutely. What are your favourite parts of the writing process? Do you like editing, for instance?
I don't mind editing. I think I like being in the world. I think I like being in that place where you are making things happen for your characters and dreaming up scenarios for them and putting them in tight spots or trying to think of things to have happen to them or that they make happen, or mistakes that they might make or solutions they might find. I like being in Sirens Bay. Like when I'm plotting out my next book, I know where I'm going to set it, in a hotel. And I know that hotel. The hotel's in the first book, which is a wonderful thing about writing a series. And I'm keen to describe it to my readers because it has a bit of a cameo role in my first book, in Sirens Bay. But in my second book, it's going to be the location for much of the story. So I'm excited about exploring what that's like inside and, yeah, more of the town.
Who can we expect to see coming back in book two from book one?
Well, the hotel needs some restoration, so Jordan would be my man for that. and there may be, Emma might need to do some reporting. I think largely I will build it around a new family, but I have Eric, who owns a bookshop, who I love. So I'd love, you know, for Eric to be in this one. There's also a character called Riley, who was a young mum in Sirens Bay, and I love her. I think she has, as an individual, I think she has so much potential, and she's been overlooked and underestimated until now. So I feel like now's maybe her moment. So
absolutely. Oh, I can't wait for book two. I loved Sirens Bay. So Cassie, what's on your reading list this summer?
Right. So I have just finished Funny Story by Emily Henry. Of course, I loved it. And now next on my reading pile is How to End a Love Story by Yulin Kwang. Mm-hmm. And it's a Reese book club pick, I believe. And the first page starts at her sister's funeral, but is also infused with humour. So it's going to be an interesting read, I think. And I like her writing. I don't know much more than that, really. I was just intrigued to read it. And then my next one would be The Catch by Amy Lee, which is also a romance, set in a small town on the coast. And she's just a really modern, fun, witty romance writer. So I really look forward to reading that too.
Thank you so much, Cassie. So how can we find and follow you and get our hands on a copy of Sirens Bay?
So Sirens Bay, you can buy on Amazon. So it's available as ebook or paperback. If you are UK based, you should be able to request it at your independent bookshop. And they can order it for you. And hopefully it will be available also at Waterstones in the near future. And my website is cassiebruceauthor.com, where I'd love for you to join my mailing list if you want to keep up with news about Sirens Bay. And you can also follow me on Insta at Cassie Bruce Writes.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. I absolutely love talking to you about Sirens Bay.
As friends gather for a hen weekend, they are all smiles, but cannot hide the web of tension that bubbles beneath the surface. The group was forever broken by the devastating loss of their childhood friend, Becca, the prettiest and most powerful of them all. Her absence lies at the heart of this fractured friendship. Now, decades later, someone wants to expose the truth about what happened and will stop at nothing to reveal the secrets long since buried. As a dark storm gathers out on the moors, dangerous secrets and accusations threaten to explode between the group. Will they survive the fallout? What stays unsaid is the gripping new thriller by Sophie Flynn, my friend and former colleague. And I'm delighted that Sophie is joining me in the Brighton Book Club studio. Welcome back, Soph.
Hello, thank you for having me. It's very nice to be here.
So congratulations on the publication of book four, which I must say is one of my favourites of yours. It really encompasses one of my biggest fears, which is Hindus going wrong.
Just Hindus in general is one of my biggest fears. <but yeah. laughs>
When did the idea come to you?
I've always thought I would write a Hindu book in some way, because I've been on a lot of Hindus. I've been on 12 Hindus and have some bonkers Hindu stories, and I just find them really fascinating. So I always thought I would try and write one. And then it just kind of came to fruition when I pitched it to my publisher, and straight away they were like, yes, we love Hindu books. So that was nice and lucky.
So if I'm right, when you started writing this book, you wanted it to not necessarily be a thriller, which is what you write, but then it just kind of took a dark, twisty turn?
Yeah, I think I had the ideas for this book and the book I'm writing at the moment, and they could have gone either way. They could have kind of been more maybe uplit or something a bit funny, but they ended up as thrillers, which I enjoyed writing. I mean, I kind of always end up writing something a bit darker, though I would still like to write something funnier one day where we don't have bodies. But, you know, that's just what I end up doing to my characters. They end up dying.
And are you a plotter?
Yeah, I really am. I think because I still work 4 days a week. And I'm always on quite tight deadlines with the books. So I don't really have the luxury of kind of, seeing where the characters take me and hoping for the best. I do have to plot it all out quite intensely before I start, which I didn't with my first book. And I have done ever since, because I've always been on those tight deadlines.
So you write often from multiple perspectives, and it's no different in What Stays Unsaid, which actually follows all of the hens, let's say, on the hen do. How do you get into the heads of your characters?
This one's got 5 points of view, which is, I've done two before. I find that quite tricky, especially when you've got kind of a 80,000-90,000 word book. I've got multi timelines as well, so we've got like a then and now section, so it was like a lot to get into in a short amount of time. So I kind of started with, I think what a lot of people do when they have lots of characters is finding like one thing about each character and kind of putting them in those, you know, the Spice Girl kind of slots. This is the funny one, this is the sporty one, this is XYZ, which worked really well for what I wanted to do anyway, because a lot of the book is really about that, kind of trying to break out the mold of who your friends decided you were when you were kind of 10 years old when you first met them. So kind of starting really one dimensional and then trying to build on top of that.
Do you think you'd be Writey Spice?
Yeah, is that a thing? No, I don't think I would be, actually, because I think Writey Spice would be like serious and clever, and I always know the exact words and would be really good at Scrabble, and I'm none of those things. I'd be a Writey Spice.
So one thing that you always do in your books too is that your setting plays a really big part in the book and in the mood of the book. So your last book was set in a kind of fictional Soho farmhouse, and this one is set on the moody Dartmouth moors. Why did you decide this?
I wanted them to go somewhere that kind of feels cut off from the world, and Dartmoor to me does really feel like that. It's creepy. You kind of, to get into Dartmoor, you have to drive down these single track lanes, which are often covered by trees, and you're just really far away from anything. And there's so much kind of lots of dark stuff with the prison and the history that's gone on there, like murders out on the moors. It's this real like juxtaposition of somewhere that's got loads of space once you're out on the moors, but to get into kind of feels like you're almost like entering a tunnel. And I just really loved that, the idea that they would feel cut off and in the middle of nowhere. And there's nothing kind of scarier, I mean, to me anyway, because I'm scared of everything, of like being in a house where you look out and there's just pitch black and you're a group of women on your own and anyone could be looking in, which always really scares me, which I realize isn't actually that normal, because when me and my friends rented a house in Malvern recently and it was all very much like that, and I said, oh, imagine who's watching us, like where would we escape if someone tried to get in? And they were like, why would you think that? I was like, oh, is that not what everyone thinks when they come into like a house down the end of a pitch black lane? Do we not all expect to get murdered? But apparently not.
Can you read some for us, please?
I will, yes. So this is the prologue. There is a moment where she almost saves her friend. Her feet inch forward, slipping in the mud, rain cascading down her face so heavily she could almost claim that she was blinded by the downpour, that she couldn't have known what was happening, couldn't have done anything. But she can. She does know, and she could have done everything. Instead, she watches as the inky black water engulfs her friend, her long hair trailing behind her. She rubs at the scratches on her wrist. Help me, the final waterlogged words ring out across the night. And that's the second moment where she could have done something, where the shock of the fall, the push, could have been broken. And she could have chosen to step forward on the bank, lean down against the cold, slippery mud and reach out to her friend. She could have pulled her out of the water. She could have done something, done anything to help her, to stop her from drowning. But she doesn't. She watches, she steps back, she lets the dark cloak of night hide her face so that she doesn't have to look her friend in the eye as she watches her die. When the screaming stops, when the water has won, she steps into the moonlight. She has never noticed before how loud the night is in the wild, but now she hears it all. Owls hooting, foxes screeching, rodents scratching at the undergrowth. She should be scared. She's out here completely alone, vulnerable and defenceless. She waits for the fear to come, but she feels nothing. She's soaked through and shivering, but her mind is still. She takes out her phone and calls the only person she can think of who will understand what she's done. Luke, she whispers into the darkness, I need your help. WhatsApp. Georgia created the group Don't Tell the Brides. Georgia added Jenny. Georgia added number. Hi ladies, now as you all know, our Super Millie has gone and got engaged super fast, which means we have not one, but two beautiful brides to be. I thought it would be super fun to combine Mills and Alex's hen-dos into one. I think they'll love it. So please keep the last weekend of May free and don't tell the brides. I want it to be a big surprise. It's been impossible getting the two of them together lately, so I know they're just going to die when they find out. Eek, can't wait. P.S. Please can you each transfer £350 to my account ASAP to cover the house, food and some super fun activities. I know it's a bit over budget we initially discussed, but it'll be so worth it and our girls deserve the best. Thanks, ladies. Georgia. Friday. Chapter 1. Millie. Now. As we pull into the farmhouse Georgia has rented for the weekend, I realise I've been fooled. This isn't going to be the nice quiet weekend for the two of us, my friend promised. This is a full-on hen-do. Georgia turns to me as she swings her 4x4 into the circular drive, the gravel flicking up and hitting the doors as she beams across at me, her face the picture of innocence. The farmhouse we've arrived at in the middle of nowhere on Dartmoor is big, far too big for two people. The dark grey brick is covered in creeping ivy, the brown painted windows small and uninviting. It's the sort of place that even looks cold, and I tuck my hands inside my jumper sleeves in preparation for the chill. When I was a kid, I would dream of the perfect family coming to whisk me away from my foster home and taking me to live in a big country farmhouse. It was the most magical thing I could picture from the confines of my soulless city centre bedrooms, different ones every few years until I was 12, but always kitted out with the same cheap blue carpet tiles on the floor and chipped magnolia paint on the walls. But now, looking at this big, dark, empty farmhouse, I realise it wasn't the house I was yearning for back then, but the big, bustling, busy family that would live inside it. The farmhouse looks cold and uninviting because it is empty. It's the sort of house that demands living bodies to bring it to life. I flick a glance over to Georgia, and I already know what she will have in store. The house is perfect setting for a group of screaming, excited women looking to celebrate without interruption. Perfect for a hen do. I should have known this would happen. When has Georgia ever wanted to come away with me on my own? I feel properly stupid and momentarily cross at Luke for convincing me this is exactly what I needed. You've got to celebrate our engagement, Mills, he said to me last night as I enthusiastically chucked a few things into my suitcase. He didn't understand that without Alex, any sort of pre-wedding celebration felt wrong. I can't even think about the fact I'm not going to Alex's own hen do in a few weeks. Guilt slides across my shoulders as I slip off my jacket, suddenly too hot in Georgia's car. I previously made a pathetic excuse to the group that I couldn't get the time off work for it, as if I'd ever let work stand in the way of celebrating my best friend. But Alex accepted my excuse straight away. It was almost too easy to avoid her, and I was angry at her for not caring that I wouldn't be there, which is mad, because that's exactly what I wanted, isn't it? I can't have both Alex and Luke, and I've made my choice. So, Georgia says now, turning off the engine of her extravagant car, I might have to admit something. As if on cue, another car, Jenny's slightly battered Ford Fiesta, swings into the drive. She jumps up, arms in the air, dancing, with a penis straw hanging out of her mouth. I laugh despite myself, then stop as the other door opens. Alex. Surprise! Georgia squeals as she jumps out of the car. My eyes don't leave Alex's as Georgia steps around the car and yanks open my door, tugging at my sleeve to force me out. Come on! Millie, Jenny shouts, running towards me with her arms wide open. It's been months since I've seen Jenny in person, not since before her own son was born. My brain scrambles for his name but draws a total blank. Bad friend. She pulls me in for a hug and I bury my face in her wild curly hair, grateful for the moment's relief it gives me from Alex's glare. Eventually I come up for air as Georgia grabs me again and envelops me in a hug between the four of us.
Thank you so much. Beautifully read, Soph. So you've spoken a bit about how you work 4 days a week and, you know, you only really have one day for writing. What's your general process? Like, how do you go from idea to like final draft that you send your publisher?
So I will usually make quite a detailed synopsis, which I send my publisher, which will be about 2,000 words long, which kind of covers everything that will happen in broad strokes. And then I find the idea of going from notebook to a book just impossible. So I have to like break it down. So I will do out a plan in Scrivener, which is a piece of software that novelists use. It kind of, I never know how to describe it if you've never seen it, but it kind of breaks the document into little folders. So I'll have like for this one, because it was a really short time frame. So we've got over from Friday to Monday. So I'd start with just literally having a folder for Friday, Saturday, Sunday. Monday? Why did my brain not know what came after Sunday? And then put each scene that I wanted to happen as a block in that, and then basically fill it out, because it feels much easier to me if I'm like, right, I've got to write this scene, rather than if I just sat down with a Word document, a never-ending Word document, and thought, I've got to write my book. I just would never write a word.
So I know that you are managing director of Jericho Writers, a publishing consultancy company. How do you find being a writer and being an author and also kind of being in the industry? Do you think it's a help or hindrance to your own writing?
I think about this last night, actually, because I realised that I've only ever worked at Jericho while I've been published. I got the job at Jericho in March 2020 and I got my first publishing deal. I think it was around June 2020 and the book came out in 2021. So while I've always worked while I've written, I do think I'm lucky in that I work somewhere that gets it. Like, no one is confused what a publication day is or like how long it takes to write a book or anything like that. So I think it's definitely helped me in that way. I think I'd find it very difficult if I had something nothing to do with writing and my kind of colleagues weren't writers and we couldn't all sit and complain about our books together. So it's definitely helped. I think being in the industry as well, like I think I'd find it hard if I was a publisher, like if I was actually responsible for how books were doing. Because you kind of would feel a little bit like you know too much. I don't think I'd want to know the inner workings of the industry quite to that degree where I could look at my own sale figures. So like we're a little bit removed at Jericho, but we get to meet amazing writers and authors and editors. And I really love it. I miss you incredibly, Anna, but you all know what it's like when we go to festival and you see everyone there and you kind of get to meet all these amazing people who are doing the same thing as you do. It's really fun. And also I'm quite lazy. Like I don't love going to events. So it's like, gets me out there talking to people without meaning I have to go to London all the time, which I wouldn't if I had any choice. So that's a positive part.
And what's the best bit of writing advice that you've ever received? Because there's a lot floating around.
I think it's maybe less writing advice and more just like life advice from Sophie Hannah, who I absolutely love, who runs a writing program called Dream Author, which is about kind of leaning into success and not resisting success. Because so many writers are quite unhappy because they're constantly always chasing after the next thing. And I think that's our kind of go-to of like, I just want a deal. Oh no, actually now I want to be all in the bookshops. Now I want a Netflix thing. Like whatever you get, it's not enough. And I learned that quite early with her, like every win is still a win. If you sell one book, that's still one book sold, and be really happy about that. And I definitely have moments where I'm not. I wish that I was kind of like Sunday Times bestseller going out on tours. But where I am now, if you told me I'd be here like 4 years ago, I'd have never believed it at all. I'd have just been completely overjoyed. So I always try and remind myself of that, rather than just kind of trying to constantly go to the next thing, because it's quite exhausting and you're never gonna be happy if that's your kind of aim of success, is just bigger and better all the time.
That's very sage advice, Soph. So what's next for you? Can you give us a little clue about the next book?
Yeah, so I've just come in from my garden where I was writing it, and it's out May next year. So it is, I do have a title, which I can't say because I don't think it will be the title, but the premise is basically two women who have the same name. So they often get each other's emails. So they've become friends over these kind of email exchanges across the years. They've never met in real life. And then one of them goes missing and the other goes and tries to find her. And obviously things go a bit wrong because it is still a thriller. And that was another idea. I thought that could be up there. That could be like a really happy, nice two women, the power of friendship coming together. But it's not. It's not. It's still...
Thank you so much for joining us, Sophie. What Stays Unsaid is out now and available from all good retailers. Soph, how can we find and follow you?
I'm probably most active on Twitter, and I think I'm just Sophie Flynn on Twitter, or I'm Sophie L. Flynn, can't remember, and on Instagram a little bit as well. And I do have a website, which is just sophieflynn.com, but it's not very good because I made it myself.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to our Summer Reads special. Make sure you subscribe to the Brighton Book Club podcast wherever you get your podcasts, and follow us on Instagram at BTM Book Club. We love hearing from listeners, and do tell us what you're reading this summer. Thank you very much.